Ballhawks.
Hey, I'm just here, so I won't get fined.
Hey und herzlich willkommen zu einer Sonderfolge des offiziellen Podcasts der German Seahawkers.
So y'all can sit here and ask me all the questions y'all want to. I'm going to answer with the same answer, so y'all can shoot if y'all please.
Ein saftiges Servus, Grüzi und Hallo zu einer weiteren Folge Ballhawks, dem offiziellen Podcast der German Seahawkers. Mein Name ist Jonas und ich bin heute, zumindest was meine Unterstützung von den German Seahawkers angeht, tatsächlich alleine da. Denn wir haben uns gedacht, in der Woche vor dem Super Bowl bieten wir euch ein bisschen Bonus-Content. Und deshalb habe ich mir wieder eine Stimme aus den USA bzw. aus Kanada eingeladen, den Kollegen Bryce Coots vom Hawk's Eye Podcast. Und der wird uns jetzt in wenigen Sekunden quasi joinen. Und deshalb werde ich jetzt, wird keine Seahawks News geben, einfach reinstarten in das Thema der Woche und wir hören uns auf der anderen Seite und zwar auf Englisch.
Touchdown Seahawks!
Competition Wednesday, das Thema der Woche.
Ja, yeah, Bryce. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jonas.
And for anyone who is wondering, you're not at home right now, right? So you're in the States.
Yeah, I'm actually down right now in Mobile, Alabama at Senior Bowl. Been down here for the week watching all the draft picks and such. And at an interesting time because when initially this was planned, I didn't expect Seattle to be potentially playing in the Super Bowl. So it's kind of made the content very interesting to do because everybody wants Super Bowl coverage at the same time. They also, some still want their draft coverage. So it's kind of worked out in a way.
Yeah, I can imagine we're all like really excited, but thankfully we have 2 weeks to prepare. So you'll be back at home for the Super Bowl, or are you going to San Fran? I don't think so, right?
No, I am not going to San Fran, but one of the members of our Seahawks syndicate, which you can see the logo behind me, Mookie Alexander, is actually going to be covering Super Bowl down in Santa Clara. So it's kind of a cool opportunity through him and through his ability as a senior editor at Field Goal. So yeah, Mookie's going to be down there covering. So we'll have some Super Bowl coverage and insight from Mookie down there. But no, I will be watching it at home in the Pacific Northwest.
Awesome. Speaking of the Super Bowl, we'll get right into it. So, how are you feeling after the Rams game? Seeing how the Seahawks played there.
I don't know how you can't feel great. Yeah, the defense, had moments where they struggled a bit in that game, but overall, you're talking about a team that was able to get crucial stops when they needed it to. The offense and Sam Darnold, I don't think there can be any more criticism of him as a quarterback. You know, the whole big thing with Sam was, can he do it in the big game? Can he win it when it's on his shoulders? And Sam Darnold went throw for throw with Matthew Stafford and honestly outplayed Matthew Stafford, which is a bingo card I don't think a lot of us had on our sheet there for him to do that. But overall, going into the Super Bowl, like, I never felt any sort of worry from the AFC side of it, whether it was Denver, even if Denver had Bo Nix, whether it was them, whether it was New England. It's just one of those things where I look at it and I go, I just don't see a complete team on the other side from the AFC. And Seattle's probably the best team in football right now.
Yeah, definitely. The way they played, it should have not been close, if you know what I'm talking about. So was there really a moment in the game where you thought, the journey stops here? Or were you always confident? Like, obviously the Reek taunting penalty, where they had the chance to go up by, I think, two or three scores even. Or were you calm?
I was relatively calm. I was very frustrated with the Reek penalty and the ensuing Nacua touchdown following. But the one thing I felt throughout most of that game after that first offensive drive and that first quarter and a half was, I don't know if the Rams can stop Seattle's offense when it's clicking. And to, watch them get the fourth down stop there and then get out of their end zone to and over midfield and drain 2 minutes off of that clock and then give the Rams the ball back with, I believe it was 20 seconds, 19 seconds left on the clock. I never felt that I'll put it this way. I never felt this was a situation where Seattle was going to lose the game. I felt if it was going to happen, it was going to be a bad bounce. Something, the ball was going to bounce the wrong way. We were going to have a fumble. I never felt like, oh, Seattle can't win this football game now because the Rams are clicking or anything. I just was like, if it is not going to happen, it's going to be because of some sort of fluke or luck play for the Rams to happen.
So thinking about that whole situation now, thinking back to 2013 and even 2014, how do you think is the sentiment about the Seahawks in the Pacific Northwest? Is it comparable to that, or is it more enthusiastic? Is it a bit less? How are you feeling? How are the people feeling over there?
I think now that this has hit the Super Bowl, I think you'll see a lot more of the fans kind of come back, maybe that were not necessarily diehards. The diehards have been there the whole time. There's been no kind of fall off from that. I think it's more the casual fan that's coming back, and I think that's why you're seeing Lumen Field have the impact that it's having again, where casual fans aren't selling off their tickets to the opposing team, and seeing more Seahawk fans in the building and in Lumen. And even in the streets, like when I left on the Monday morning out of SeaTac, it was green and blue everywhere, which was very difficult for my Raiders fans seeing all the blue and green because it was not something we enjoyed seeing. But as we were leaving the airport, I think it's the one thing I'll say about 2013 and 14 to this team is I think John Schneider actually put it really well. The 2013 and 2014 was very much an edgy team because it was, we're going to prove the world wrong. We've been wronged. We're going to prove them wrong. This group is more of a connected kind of grouping, and they're just so much more in sync with each other. And I think they're just more about the hard work and stuff. And it was funny because on my flight down to Houston, because I had to go Houston to Mobile, two rows in front of me in the plane was Ricardo Lockett, ex-Seahawk that was there for years. And so when the plane landed, I got an opportunity to talk to Ricardo for a few minutes. And he even said, he goes, this team is even more connected than the 2013-2014 team. And he said, it wasn't that we weren't connected, but this group really is like offense, defense, special teams. They're just one true heartbeat of a team, where sometimes you get teams that are connected, but the offensive guys tend to hang out with themselves and the defensive guys tend to hang out with themselves. And you get the odd player like a Marshawn Lynch that can kind of just go across those barriers. Mm-hmm. He's loved by all.
Yeah.
But this is where I think you see the Ernest Jones going out and defending Russell Wilson. You didn't see that much out of those LOB teams hey, we're going to go out of our way to defend Russell at points. It was with Ernest. It's like, even on the sidelines, he was saying, I don't know if you've seen the mic'd up piece yet.
It's
on YouTube. Where he's saying y'all doubted 14.
Yeah.
Y'all doubted 14. And that's just a different vibe to this team, which is why I think this team might actually have an opportunity to have more long sustained success than those 2013-2014 teams did.
Yeah. Personally, I in 2013-2014, I was a really, really new fan to the Seahawks because it all started here in Germany with the with the TV and stuff. So I'm probably a bit more intense right now. So I want the team to get it. How are you personally feeling?
I'm actually relatively calm about the whole going to the Super Bowl. I mean, because for me, I had the mindset this team was a year away still. Even though I projected, 13-4 and they were going to win two playoff games, everything when I did my season predictions, I still thought this team as a whole was a year away. They could be 13-4 and lose a playoff game, whether it's the divisional round or whatever, and I'd still be okay with that because it's like, wow, they kind of exceeded the expectation. They've really exceeded that expectation now being in the Super Bowl because this is where I expected them to be next year. So it's almost like you're playing with house money in a way, in my opinion, with this team. Like if things don't go well and they don't win the Super Bowl, I'm not going to look at the season as a failure.
Yeah.
I'm going to look at it as a massive success. You got to the Super Bowl a year ahead of schedule of where I thought they were. And even listening to John Schneider's press conference yesterday that he did, I think he's even thinking this team's a little bit ahead of schedule and overachieved a little bit. He won't come out and say that directly, But I think that's something, if you kind of read the tea leaves a little bit, it's kind of where he's even feeling with this team.
Yeah. But you feel like the sentiment is, yeah, we have to get it now, because you can't really plan for those things. Even I or we said, okay, like you said, we're a year away, but saying like, okay, yeah, if we don't win it this year, we'll win it next year. I don't think you can plan for that. So they have to get it all right.
Yep. No, they do. And you know, there's obviously all the talk right now surrounding Clint Kubiak and what's going to go on there. And you don't know what could happen on that front. So you kind of do have to win it now, because you could not make it back, right? Like, yep, you said, could be sitting here 4 years from now going, man, we only had the one opportunity with this group, because other teams will get better. Bounces won't go your way. Injury health won't go your way. So yep. I'll say this. I think everything is in front of Seattle to be a very successful team over the next 5 to 6 years. But right now is a real opportunity to kind of grab one with house money and go, yeah, like, we got this early. And if they get one 3 years from now again, it'll be like, okay, yeah, this one we kind of more or less expected. That first one was kind of a luxury item.
Yeah. So you were saying like you thought 13-4, so it's borderline Super Bowl, like you said. It's not all always that easy, or it isn't easy at all, but that sure to win a playoff game. When we look at, we were very bullish on the Seahawks as well. We were saying, like, I think I said 12-5 probably. When you look at the people or the experts that even saw the Seahawks like worse than the Cardinals, I think every one of us kept receipts or the Vegas line before the season, like 7.5 games. How are you feeling about, yeah, we proved them wrong, or we were right?
I think it's a more of, when I look at what these national analysts go, they have to make something to talk about, right, Jonas? They have to have something to talk about. And saying the Seahawks are going to finish fourth in division or third in the division. And, you know, they went through, like, everyone was basically grabbing onto the fact you traded away Geno, you traded away DK, you cut Tyler Lockett. Like, all these key iconic players for Seattle are now moved on. You have a second-year coach, and there's this massive turnover now on the offensive side of the ball. And I think what you're now seeing with this team is John Schneider is an elite talent evaluator. And when he's now in full control of it, there's a different kind of flow to how this organization runs than even was there, I think, in a lot of ways. And, okay, we're going to go take a risk on a guy that fits culturally what we want to do in Sam Darnold. Like, you look how Sam has, like, literally come in, been a leader. You listen to how the teammates talking. You go out and get a Cooper Kupp, who, again, Super Bowl champion, has a certain pedigree, has a certain leadership style, work ethic, all those things. You go get Tank Lawrence. Like, you look at the move Seattle made. It wasn't a, hey, we're just going to kind of be okay. Like, we're going to roll with Drew Locke and we're going to just, you know, wait till the draft. It was, how do we reload this, but reload this where it's more of an alignment with what our head coach and our philosophy now is as an organization. And I think that's the biggest thing on why they were so successful is, you brought in guys that have a certain type of work ethic. And yeah, Cooper Kupp doesn't have a 1,000-yard season. He's not the Cooper Kupp that he was with the Rams. But I will say this on Cooper Kupp's half of this, where I think a lot of Seahawks fans even are kind of like underwhelmed by what he did this year. Cooper Kupp didn't have to be the way the offense functioned and the way teams struggled to take JSN away. Cooper Kupp didn't get the target volume because the passing volume wasn't there. We had the 25th highest pass rate in the NFL, which is at the bottom. Yep. We're talking about a quarterback like Sam Darnold. I think only had 2 or 3 games where he threw over 35 passes, one being the NFC Championship game throughout the season. So when your other receiver's getting 10, 9, 11 targets, there's not much to go around for everybody else. Yeah. In the group. They're going to end up with 3 or 4. But what I'll say is, over the last 2 games with Cooper Kupp, you see his value. Cooper Kupp in the divisional round, leading receiver on the team. Cooper Kupp in the NFC Championship game had 6 targets, 4 catches, 36 yards and a touchdown. But if you look at all those catches, a lot of them were third down conversions, which you needed to sustain drives. Tank Lawrence and his impact. You're talking about a guy that came in here and looks rejuvenated playing in Seattle's system, was healthy outside of one game this year. Like, you see the impact of these players. And, you know, you talked about Sam Darnold, like, calming down that entire offense, that, you know, just the way he operates, he doesn't let what people are saying. Like, you think about it, you know, this last year with Geno and all the times where, you know, the Minnesota game where they lose to Sam Darnold and a fan says something and Geno tries to go and fight the fan in the stands. Like,
yeah.
You never saw Sam do that. Sam just kind of stays the same level. He's like literally a calm lake. It doesn't matter. There's a ripple there. Nothing changes. It just stays the same. And so I think when you look at this team and why they were so successful is you had guys that came in that could also lead and get others to buy into the culture, but didn't come in and rock the boat. They didn't come in and rock the Witherspoons or the Leos. And like, you know, Tank didn't come in and be like, I'm going to be the leader of the Seahawks defense. He just kind of came in, let his play doing the talking, and then kind of watched as it grew.
Yeah, I think what you said there is really important. It's not like always having to watch the stats, but also, yeah, what do those players do beyond like catching balls or getting sacks? I find it pretty funny or pretty interesting because I see like Cooper as well, like a on-field coach more or less. That's the quality he brings. Like, I listened to the podcast of Andrew Whitworth and Ryan Fitzpatrick, and like Andrew Whitworth played with Cooper Kupp, and watching the NFC Championship game, he said the call on the JSN touchdown could have been a Cooper Kupp play, like Cooper going into the huddle and saying, "Okay, we're gonna run this play." So I think that's something that's really underestimated, like the quality beyond the catches.
Oh, it totally is. It's 100% a value of Cooper Kupp, and you look at the way he run blocks, how unselfish he is run blocking. Like, you saw the little bubble screen JSN catches, and his block is the key block that allows JSN to go for 10, 15 yards. And that was just a normal thing that I think in some respects, when we look at this run game resurgence over the back half of the season, when I've been down here in Alabama, one of the gentlemen I got to talk to was Brian Baldinger, NFL ex-offensive lineman, does a great job doing breakdowns on Twitter. If you follow his Twitter, it's amazing stuff. But I asked him, like, what led to Seattle's kind of back half of the season resurgence in their run game? You saw Ken Walker and all these numbers start to come in. I said, did they change something in their scheme? He goes, no. He said, the biggest thing was, is you saw the receivers, all of them, become better blockers and the tight ends become better blockers. And he goes, even JSN is a better blocker now than he was at the beginning of the year. And he even said, he goes, that's a direct result of the Cooper Kupp effect of what he has in your receiver room. And that, to your point, goes into that coaching kind of mentality that Kupp brings to this organization and that leadership role that he does bring to this organization.
Yeah, it's just I really like the Cooper Kupp signing, and I'm not like, okay, he had to get 1,000 yards or something like that. So I'm really happy with him. Looking beyond this season, like when you see the success the Seahawks have under Mike McDonald and are on the analyst radar now, where do you see Seattle like in the NFC West, particularly in the relation to the Niners and the Rams? Obviously, the Niners are getting older with their electrical substation as well, and you see a race between the Rams and the Seahawks?
I do and I don't. It's really interesting for me because I look at the Rams now as what the LOB was post the two Super Bowl runs, where we tried to hang on to some things. We were there. We had opportunities. We kept feeling we were closer and, you know, we needed this piece or we needed this piece to get there. I look now at the Seahawks as they're what the 49ers and Rams were when they kind of were in that same situation where we were kind of coming out of the cusp of the LOB and into the Let Russ Cook era. We're now those teams because we're young. Like, you look at this entire team, like we talked about it on Syndicate last night, and Dan Vian's has brought up numerous times on the show, is you can basically almost bring back this entire roster next year. Yep. You could re-bring back all 53 guys and even guys on the practice squad again and run the whole group back again, which a lot of teams can't say. And we're talking about players where like Julian Love, and we look at him, we're like, hey, Julian's been here a couple of years. Julian Love's only a 27-year-old safety. He's still 3 years from 30. Like, you know, yes, guys like a Tank Lawrence and Big Cat are the guys you got to kind of start looking at in the Jaren Reed, but Ernest Jones is under 30. Drake Thomas, Derek Hall, like the list goes on and on of guys that you're like going, like the whole offensive line's under contract for next year. So it's not a situation where you look at this team and go, okay, so like, okay, Seattle wins the Super Bowl this year. How do we refill a quarter to a half of our roster because guys are old, we need to get younger? You're going, okay, how do we add to this group and keep the core there and just add the little extra? Oh, do we need an elite edge rusher? Okay, we'll go out and get that. Like, that's where I find it so interesting with the draft process this year for Seattle, because it's a situation of they don't have a bunch of glaring needs where you're like, okay, you have to get picks because you got to get a lot of the cracks of the apple to go get this type of player. You're sitting there going like, okay, what do we add to this group to make it even better than what it currently is? Where I look at a Rams team, it's like, okay, you got to start thinking about quarterback. Matthew Stafford, is he coming back? The receiving core outside of Nacua, are you paying Puka Nacua? Are you going to trade Nacua? What's his longevity look like? You know, how much longer does Devontae Adams have in the tank? Sorry about that. My phone just
decided. No worries.
But that's where you start looking at those things. To your point about the Niners and their substation issues, all their elite players are coming up on 30 or older.
Yep.
You have a system quarterback in Brock Purdy that, yes, he can do some great things when there's a whole bunch of things around him. But when he's asked to do more than that, you see his limitations creep up, as we did in the divisional game. It's really interesting because I think Seattle's kind of alone. It could look like more in this NFC West, more like what it did when Mike Holmgren was the coach, at the point where Seattle kind of gets two steps ahead of everybody else and stays there for a bit, than it did with Pete, where it was like, okay, we started coming off of our precipice of being successful, and the Rams and Niners ascended to being better teams in the NFL.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well. Like, you see the Rams being there with the Seahawks, having really good games, really good season series against them. But there's like the question of Matt Stafford, and you see how important he is. The Seahawks do have Sam Darnold now, and I think the narrative that he's going to choke in big games can be put to rest now after the NFC Championship game. So, having seen all of that, where do you see him like in the quarterback rankings in the NFL?
So I've been saying this since probably about week 5 of the season that he's a top 10 NFL quarterback, and I keep getting pushback on it. And the way I look at it, I actually had Garrett Greenlee on my show from Football Analysis on YouTube, and we kind of talked about just the franchise quarterback in the NFL, the top 10 quarterbacks in the NFL. And there's the four guys. There's Joe Burrow, Josh Allen, Patrick Mahomes, Matt Stafford. Those are like your four elite level guys. I think that's safe to say. 5 through 10 are kind of a moving piece and game of Jenga, right? Like, you've got Lamar Jackson's in there. You've got, you know, Dak Prescott's one of the other guys I would throw in that conversation from 5 through 10. You can put Justin Herbert in there when he's playing well. Sam Darnold belongs in that conversation now as one of those guys. You know, Drake May, who he's going to play against in the Super Bowl, is a guy you throw into that conversation. Jared Goff. Like, there's a whole bunch of guys that kind of can rotate through there, where I look at Sam and it's like, 1 week or for a stretch, Sam could be at number 5 on that list. And other weeks, he's number 8 on that list, but he's still within the top 10. And the way I break it down now, Jonas, is I look at it and I go, okay, there is 4 elite franchise. And I put that elite term in front of franchise quarterback now, with Josh Allen's, Patrick Mahomes, so on. Then that 5 through 10 are franchise quarterbacks. That's what you need them to be. They're franchise quarterbacks. Sam Darnold is a franchise level quarterback. He's not an elite, like one of the top 4. Now, I will say this, there is an opportunity for him to be there. We're talking about a guy that's only 28, that is now going to start playing his best football, seems to have finally figured it all out, and he has top 4 level skill in the NFL. He does. He's got the big arm. He's got the mobility. He's got a bunch of those things. There's an opportunity here that Sam Darnold goes from being 5 through 10 and pushes himself into a 4 or a 3 spot in there, depending on how he does over the next bit. And I know some people may think that's absolutely crazy because they choose to keep looking back at his Jets, Panthers days and stuff and won't let that go. It's like a two-part to a career for a player, right? Like, you look at Matthew Stafford as an example. If Matthew Stafford stayed with the Detroit Lions, Matthew Stafford is not the guy we're talking about right now. He was he had a big arm in Detroit, but he could never get over the hump. He could never win the playoff games in Detroit. He couldn't do anything. Gets traded to L.A., wins a Super Bowl. All of a sudden, we're talking about Matthew Stafford now as the number 4, number 3 top quarterback in the NFL. We're talking about him as being a league MVP at 39 because of the fact he got into the right situation with the right coaches, with the right scheme, they were able to elevate him. You could have that with Sam Darnold, but you're getting that with Sam Darnold like 5 years in advance of when the trade was made, you know, in some respects for Matthew Stafford. And so that's where I look at when people judge quarterbacks and why these reclamation projects are so interesting when they have the top end talent. Because a lot of the time it's scheme, it's system, it's coaching that you get. And this is why I look at so many quarterbacks, and it's so unfortunate they go to such bad organizations when they get drafted, like the Jets, and people cast them off so quickly, being like, yeah, he can't do it, he's a bust. Well, what happens if you take that guy and you put him in the right situation where he's got good coaching, he's got the right circumstances around him, and see what he does? And then if he can't pull it off then yeah, you probably have more of a credit to him being a bust than you do of just predetermining that because he was with a shitty organization like the Jets or the Browns or the Raiders.
Totally. Like we've seen against the Rams, what Sam is capable of doing if he finally, I don't know, if he going into your expertise, how did you see him playing against Rams? Did he figure something out for himself, or was it more, did Clint Kubiak figure something out? How did they do it?
I think it was a twofold. I think it was both of them. I think Kubiak did a really good job of using formational switches to cause problems for the Rams. Part of that being motioning JSN to being like a offset wing slot / running back. And some of those, like how JSN got his touchdown, you really stress the defense in that, because are you asking your linebacker to now go out and cover JSN, which is an automatic mismatch? Are you asking your corner to hopefully get into the right spot in his drop to take it away, which then may lead to Cup being open underneath or somebody else? Or are you asking your safety to roll down and cover that, and again gives you a tell? So that was something that I thought that was really impressive by Kubiak, to use just a way of positioning one of your best players to get him a mismatch based on their schematic structure on defense. Now, the Sam Darnold part, yes, I think Sam figured some things out. And I think when we all looked at that back half there of the season from that Rams 4 interception game, I think what you saw was from the Rams to the Rams game, you saw Sam kind of not regress, but kind of be more protective of the football. And I think Kubiak was a little bit too in what he was calling. And Sam was like, I'm not going to press anything. I'm not going to take shots. I don't want to have this happen again. So I think there was a bit of a shell shock there a little bit with Sam. Then you get the second Rams game where they're playing on Thursday night. And, you know, the two interceptions happen early on, which I put a little bit on Kubiak and some of the schemes he was coming up with, and the Rams just knowing what they were going to do tendency-wise. And then you watch Sam through the back half of that game, and you kind of saw this balance, or like this moment of like calmness come to Sam, where it's like, I can still rip the ball and take these explosive shots, as well as playing safe and within myself and within the structure. Like, I just have to know when to take those shots and don't force the shots. And you saw that with the overtime drive, where he makes the great throw to Cooper Kupp, and then the great throw to JSN, and then to Sauber, and we win the game. Mm-hmm. And then what you saw, I think, over the back half was Sam really going to the, hey, I just need to do what I do well. When the opportunities present themselves, I will take my shots at them and let it rip. And you've seen that get better and better. The Niners game the first time, hey, I don't need to do anything, but I'll make some big throws when I need to make them. You look at the Niners game in the playoffs, same thing. Hey, we can lean on the run game. I don't need to throw the ball, really. Yeah, I'm injured. But you know what? When I do get my number called, I'll let it rip and make throws. And then the Rams game was like, I think what we will expect from Sam going forward is that type of quarterback where he throws the deep shot when he knows what he's got outside to Shahid. He's ripping the ball in the tight windows. He's doing a lot of those things. But then he's also the guy that's smart enough to, like, on the Cooper Kupp touchdown, go through his progressions and go, hey, there's JSN, there's my, okay, there's Kupp, and I'm going to lead him. And the thing with that Kupp touchdown is, and, you know, we were watching the game last night again, myself, Brandon Kane, and Dan brought it up too, which is something I noticed, but he actually said it, was he threw Kupp open towards the end zone because he knew what the space was. Instead of just putting the ball right on him, he actually led him in the direction he wanted him to go, which led to Cooper Kupp having some momentum to get into the end zone. Those are small things Sam wasn't necessarily doing at the beginning of the year, the middle of the year, but it's now that he's gone through this whole season with support without getting, you know, blasted in the media. Because to the point of that four interception game, what does Ernest Jones come out and say? Basically, I'm not going to say it, but screw everybody, Sam's our guy.
Yep.
Instead of going like, yeah, you know, the offense could have been better today, this, that, and the other, the team supported Sam, which allowed him to know, hey, I can just go out and be me and not have to change that. And this is now the product you're getting because of the team being able to support him properly and organizationally support him to allow him to feel comfortable enough to go through that growth period.
Yeah. Well, the thing I think everybody is asking themselves, or the 12s are asking themselves, looking at Sam and obviously his relationship with Clint Kubiak. If Clint Kubiak leaves, which is something that it's not out of the question. If you look at the news coming out of the NFL, do you think Sam will regress, or will there be another offensive coordinator he can click with?
I think there's another offensive coordinator he can click with, and I think part of it too is you're looking for someone that has a certain style about them. So if you hire within house, whether it's Jake Peets or Justin Outen to replace Kubiak after he leaves, you're going to have that relationship. They already know what Sam's good at. They have a philosophy that's similar to what Clint does. Sam needs a run game and play action to be really at his best. And those are things, you know, I think, you know, there's two coordinators out there if you were going to go hire outside. One of them is Arthur Smith, and the other one is Matt Nagy, in my opinion, where you could potentially, if you wanted to hire outside the organization because you needed to, those are guys, I think, again, that run the football, especially Arthur Smith, who would be my first choice. They run the zone scheme. They run play action a lot. They do those things. And when Arthur Smith has been an offensive coordinator, he has done a very good job of, you know, helping quarterbacks grow. For an example, at Tennessee, look what he did with Ryan Tannehill. Ryan Tannehill, up until he was in Tennessee, could not play quarterback successfully in the NFL. He just couldn't. He was a washout of Miami, all these things. He was a, you know, NFL first round pick. Arthur Smith gets a hold of him. They start running the football. They start living off of play action. All of a sudden, Ryan Tannehill is a top 10 quarterback, top 15 quarterback during that small time period in the NFL, mm-hmm. in Tennessee winning football games. But no one saw that from Ryan Tannehill in Miami or any of the other, you know, the other places he was. So that's where I look at it and I go, okay, if we're going to bring a guy in to replace Kubiak, you want to follow the same kind of footsteps and the way that they build their offense. Arthur Smith is the ideal guy. And the interesting thing about Arthur Smith is that he hasn't necessarily signed his contract at Ohio State, where he has gone mm-hmm. to be a college coordinator, which I think is his agent being in contact with Seattle. Because when Mike McDonald initially came to Seattle, Arthur Smith was his first choice for offensive coordinator. That's who he wanted. But Arthur Smith couldn't wait out the process for Mike to get hired and took the job in Pittsburgh. Even look at what he did in Pittsburgh. He was able to have a functional offense that almost made it to the playoffs 2 years in a row with Justin Fields and a washed up Russell Wilson as his quarterbacks the first time. And then a washed up, beat up 40-year-old plus Aaron Rodgers. He got into the playoffs without having a proper running game or offensive weapons around it. So, yeah. If you now tell him, hey, come to Seattle, you're going to get all of this, an entire offense is coming back with a Sam Darnold, a Kenneth Walker potentially coming back, JSN, Cooper Kupp, Torrey Horton, Rasheed. Like, if I'm an OC, I'm going, yeah, I can come in here. And you say to him, hey, look, come here, be our OC for a couple of years. You will have a great opportunity to be an NFL head coach again when you can prove it works here.
Yeah. Talking about the ripple effect Clint Kubiak signing by the Raiders could have, he obviously brought a lot of coaches with him to Seattle, like looking at Rick Dennison or the one everybody thinks or we think is probably the most important one concerning the team, how the team got on. it's obviously John Benton. So what do you think would be the ripple effect if Kubiak goes? Who will go with him? Who will stay? And yeah, how challenging would it be for the Seahawks? Because if you look at the time frame now, so we're at the Super Bowl. It's like really late. So getting a staff together, getting a scheme to go. So what are your, I wouldn't say fears there, but what could be an issue? Who could go with Kubiak?
I think one for sure that will go is Andrew Janoco, because I think he'll take him as his offensive coordinator. I think it's a toss-up between Rick Dennison and John Benton on who goes with Kubiak. Because, for example, if Seattle decides to, you know, elevate Justin Outen to offensive coordinator, because he does have experience calling plays in the NFL, I think you have a case to keep John Benton, because him and John Benton have worked so closely together this year. I feel Rick Dennison will follow Clint because there's a very strong family tie there. I think Janoco will follow because Clint will say, hey, come be my offensive coordinator in Vegas or wherever he ends up. And, you know, I think that's kind of where it'll stop, because Jake Peets, I think, will stay here. There's no prior connection with Clint. And if it's an elevation where, you know, potentially they do something similar to what they did in 2013, 2014 with Bevel and Cable, which was Bevel called the pass plays, Cable called the run plays, you could have a similar situation to even what they proposed last year when they were looking at Hank Fraley as an offensive coordinator, was, hey, like, we'll pair him with a really good pass game coordinator. If you say to Peets, hey, look, you're really like the passing game coordinator / OC because you're going to call the passing plays, maybe that's how you can keep a majority of this group together. Again, it all depends on, you know, the Kubiak situation. When he goes, how much did he guarantee that he was? Because Seattle can block a lot of these, right? If they're lateral moves, Seattle could block a lot of them, right? Like, are you going to promote John Benton to run game coordinator and so on? Because Seattle may turn around and do that. They may go, hey, Justin Outen, you're the offensive coordinator. Now John Benton's O-line and run game coordinator. And all of a sudden now, you can't promote John Benton any higher unless you make him an offensive coordinator. So now you're not taking Janoco, because if you don't take Janoco as an OC, he's only a quarterback coach, then Seattle could theoretically block him, right, from leaving. So it's really a game of chess now in some respects. And I think, you know, who knows what's going on in that building. I got a feeling Seattle, you know, and Mike are going to be really supportive of what Clint's doing if he decides to go. I still think it's in my personal opinion, I think it's a foolish move in some respects for Clint to leave, because none of the two teams that are remaining in Arizona or Vegas have anything really about them that are attractive. Vegas has a track record now of turning over coaches that aren't immediately successful. You're going to have Tom Brady looking over your shoulder constantly at what you're doing, and you don't have a direct path to a good quarterback. Like, you don't. Mendoza, in my regard, is a third round level quarterback, but he's getting propped up to the first round because of how weak this class is as a whole. This is where it makes it very interesting. Okay, you could wait it out another year, Clint, come back to a stable situation in Seattle. And next year we could be talking about Cincinnati not having a coach because Zach Taylor gets fired. Oh, that's more attractive. Jamar Chase, T. Higgins, Joe Burrow, like, you could go make it work there. Or maybe Minnesota crashes out again and Kevin O'Connell's let go because of the whole J.J. McCarthy, Sam Darnold fiasco that's over the last couple of years. Like, there may be better organizational opportunities next coaching cycle than there is now.
This is like I wouldn't say the distant future, but the more distant future, the more immediate future is obviously the Super Bowl. And when we talk about the Super Bowl, we look at it. The Seahawks are definitely the favorites, but will it be what kind of Super Bowl would you expect? Will it be that easy? Like, or will it be easy as people are saying? Like, a lot of people see a blowout coming or something like that, or will it be a tighter game?
I think it'll be a tighter game for the first quarter and a half. I think New England's going to put up a good fight to start with. They're a feisty team. They're coached by a tough coach in Mike Vrabel, but I think talent, depth, and just overall team build, Seattle will run away with the game in the second half. Where it'll feel, I think the best way to describe it is it'll feel kind of like an Atlanta game. Remember we had those games there in the middle of the year where we were like, hey, first half it was close. And then all of a sudden Seattle hit the gas in the second half and just kind of left. That's what I think will kind of happen in the Super Bowl. We may be talking about a 17-10 game going into halftime with Seattle up. And then all of a sudden we come out, Seattle gets the ball, and now it's 24-10. And then they get a turnover, and then they go down, and now it's 31-10. And all of a sudden it's just you're stacking plays, as Mike McDonald likes to say, you're stacking plays on plays on plays. That's where you kind of get going, and it might be hard because I just, for me, we're not talking about a situation with Seattle where it's like, oh, they don't have a great run game. It's New England's got really good, you know, running backs. So the run defense for Seattle is going to be really tough to deal with, you know, because of this, that. It's like, no, Seattle is a top defense in the run. They are a top pass defense. How are you going to exploit those with a quarterback? And another interesting stat, any quarterback under the age of 24 currently, going back to 2023 with Sam or with Mike McDonald as defensive coordinator for the Ravens, are 0-6 with one touchdown pass to 8 interceptions. Like, that is not a good track record. Those numbers don't add up well. And you're asking Drake May to go and play against this defense. And I know some people out there going, oh, well, they played against Baltimore and that's the same defense. It is not the same defense. You're dealing with a guy. It's like the whole McVay effect. Hey, you got Shane Waldron as your OC. You're going to run the exact same offense as the Rams. No, you're not. You don't have the original architect that understands every nuance of that scheme and system. Where with Seattle, you're dealing with that with Mike McDonald, where he's going to sit there and go, yeah, okay, you think we're doing this, but now we're doing this. I expect, actually, Seattle come out and go after May early on defensively and pressure him with blitzes and different things and create problems. And I hate to say it, if you look at the New England Patriots schedule, the quarterbacks they played, even through the playoffs, New England hasn't played anybody, and they struggled to win some of those playoff games. If the Texans have a, you know, comparable offense that can actually do something, and they aren't missing Nico Collins, Texans might be playing Denver for the AFC Championship. You go to the Denver game, Denver's got their backup quarterback that hasn't thrown a ball in a year and a half, and they only lose 10-7, and all those points were scored in the first half. If Denver kicks a field goal instead of going for it on fourth down, and their quarterback doesn't do a two-handed backward shovel and just takes the sack, there's a good chance that New England's not even playing us in the Super Bowl, and it's Denver with Jared Stidham because they couldn't score on Denver's defense.
I think I'm not as tense as I was before the Rams game. Like I'm still not saying, oh, we got this one in the bag, and it's our game to lose. You obviously said that there's a good chance that the Seahawks will win this game. Looking at the Patriots, they still are dangerous. They still made it to the playoffs as the second seed in the AFC. Is there like a specific player the 12s have to keep an eye on, because he could be dangerous? Like you obviously have Drake May, Travion Henderson, Stephon Diggs, Milton Williams, Christian Gonzalez. Is there another player you say, oh, yeah, the Seahawks have to keep an eye on him there?
I'd probably say Hunter Henry, their tight end. He's someone that can just be a sneaky guy that can convert third downs for them. It's kind of that safety blanket for Drake May, very much like a George Kittle is for a Brock Purdy kind of a thing. And at points this year, Seattle has struggled to cover tight ends. So that's where I would say is like the only kind of thing where I'm like, that's kind of worrisome. Outside of that, I think, you know, Seattle, again, matches up very well, and it favors them a lot in a lot of ways.
You already hinted at it. Like how could Mike with this defense attack the Patriots? Obviously, you had, it would be good to like you said with the young quarterback to rattle him early to show more pressure than usual. So will it be like, okay, we're gonna call more blitzes, call more man coverage, giving something to the Patriots they haven't seen in a while, or will Mike stick to its guns and say, all right, we're gonna do our thing here because it worked for us, they have to beat us.
That's an interesting one. I think you see a mix from Mike. I think he might come out and pressure a bit more. And then I think he's going to go back to what he knows and what the team does well. So I think it's going to be, how do we confuse May with simple things? And then we'll start to go. And once we get a bit of a lead, then we'll really open up Pandora's box and, excuse me, let him have it.
Yeah, I think it's really, really exciting to see, because also what does Clint Kubiak have in his bag? There were like the first injury report out came out yesterday. I think if I'm not mistaken, there's like a week to go to, or more than a week to go to towards the Super Bowl. The Seahawks seem to be reasonably healthy, but is there an injury that would be concerning to you, or are you saying, all right, it's going to be fine, like Sam's oblique is fine, and there's the JSN is fine, is healthy, Ken Walker is healthy, the key players on defense are healthy, or is there like pointing towards Robbie Lutz maybe?
Robbie Utes is probably the one for me, you know, that I think affects the run game enough. We saw a little bit of that in the Rams game. He's limited right now with the neck injury, which I think is a stinger he got in the divisional game. The fact he's limited is a positive thing, but he's a guy that I think has such an impact that if you can have him back for the Super Bowl, could make a huge, huge difference in the run game.
Yeah, the run game is like we've seen it helped out Sam a lot. We talked about it, like Ken Walker is the one the Seahawks have to rely on now because of the ACL with Zach Charbonnet. If you look at that Seahawks roster, is there a player you'd be most happy for to get a ring, or are you saying, all right, they all deserve it?
I definitely look at it and I kind of go, you know, there's guys all over this team I look at. Like, I'd love to see, you know, Big Cat get it. I'd love to see the whole team get it. The one player for me that actually stands out, doesn't play a lot, and that's Quandre Diggs. I'd love for Quandre Diggs to finally have a ring for everything he did coming in, you know, and helping Seattle through that, you know, stretch of time there with Russ and Geno and everything. He would be a guy for me that I would be extremely, him and Shaq would be a guy.
Yeah, there are like a couple of players. Even we had a bit of a discussion, a friendly discussion in our German Seahawks chat, and I personally said like these are all good shouts, like Quandre and Shaq. I would really like for Tank Lawrence to get a ring, because he did this interview with Brian Amhauser after he signed, and the foreshadowing, like, okay, I wouldn't get a ring in Dallas, so I come to Seattle, and seeing that concluded would be really fun in my eyes. Yeah.
Wenn du unseren Podcast unterstützen willst, dann bewerte ihn in deinem Podcast-Player oder kommentiere unsere Folge. Du kannst uns auch direkt anschreiben per Mail an podcast@germanseahawkers.com.
We talked about it, or you talked about it. You're at the Senior Bowl now, like closing this thing out with Dan Viens from Seahawks Forever and Brandon Cain from the Hawks Nest. What did you see and hear so far at Mobile?
It's been an interesting group here at Mobile. It's nowhere near the class it was last year. And I think we've all heard that about this draft class. It's a bit of a down year, but there's still some intriguing prospects. What I'll say about this draft class this year is it's more of a floor class. The floor is a lot more stable in this class than there is a massively high ceiling. And so, like, there's, for the Seahawks' needs, it kind of matches up well. Like, there's really good trench play on the defensive side of the ball. The offensive line is interesting. Again, I don't know if you go out in there looking like you need to add somebody, which may be shocking to everybody, but I think you roll back the group of five again, mm-hmm. and maybe you look to add someone to upgrade Christian Haynes' spot. I don't know if he's a fit in Seattle. But the edges are really interesting. There's a few names that have really stood out to me. There's some corners here that I think are interesting fits for Seattle that you could probably get. And there's some interesting receivers too, which I think are another interesting part of this. Because again, I think Seattle needs to not bank on necessarily Torrey Horton being a 100% healthy receiver all the time. You got Jake Bobo and Derek Young. I get that. And Bobo obviously had the big touchdown in the NFC Championship game. But you want to try and upgrade that back half with athleticism. So some names that have stood out to me, you know, on the edge side of things, Zion Young, an edge from Missouri. He's a big early down setter. He does a lot of interior type stunts, but he's got length, power, edge discipline. He's basically he's kind of a B version of Tank Lawrence. Guy I really like. He's really made an impact here in the Senior Bowl. Like, he's had some great one-on-one reps. So he's a guy that I would keep an eye on. Derek Moore, another edge from Michigan. He's another big kind of edge. Because the thing with Seattle now is the edge role has changed very much. They play this wide 9, wide 10 role, which I got to give Brandon King credit for. Kind of said, like, it's an extra half yard outside the wide 9, so let's call it a wide 10. But it's really about bull rushing, getting there, and then reading it as a two-way goal. And we've seen Tank and Derek Hall really do that well this year. So those are two guys. Another interesting guy that I think can rotate on the interior a bit, play a little bit outside, but can kind of help maybe, you know, backfill the Jaren Reed, Byron Murphy thing is Gabe Jackus, who's a D lineman from Illinois. He's had a really good week. He's very versatile. You know, he's not super twitchy, but he's another guy I think you could go get. Zane Durant, an interior D lineman from Penn State, very much a Puna Ford type player where, again, you need to start thinking about the Jaren Reeds and stuff. For corners, Chandler Rivers, who's a outside corner right now in college, but you could slide him into nickel from Duke. Really good player. He is very sticky in coverage. He's aggressive. Sometimes he gets outside. He's a little smaller, but he's an interesting guy. For offensive line people, because I know everyone will want to hear me say one name to keep an eye on is Jeremiah Wright. He's a guard from Auburn. He had some really good reps throughout the 3 days I was here, but there was a period in day two against LT Overton, the Alabama edge that everyone's kind of been talking about, where he was able to match him power for power and hold him up. Couple running backs, actually, and I know that's an interesting thing to be talking about, but Katron Allen, the running back out of Penn State, is someone I really like, as well as Kalen Black, the running back out of Indiana, are two guys I think that could come in and be upgrades on a Kenny McIntosh, and maybe even to an extent athletic upgrades over a Zach Charbonnet, depending on what he comes back from his injury. And then another corner, Jalen Kilgore from South Carolina is a guy that I really like. I think he can play inside out. He's a guy. Then there's a couple of receivers here. Virgil Green, a receiver from Texas Tech, lengthy, tall. I think he's about 6'2", made some really impressive plays. There is a smaller slot guy, if you were going to replace a Cooper Kupp, I think, that could be an interesting guy, which is Cyrus Allen. He's a receiver out of Cincinnati. He's so good at separating in space, whether it's press, whether it's off man. Like, he's just so good at getting in and out of his run breaks, or his route breaks, I should say. And another guy that I think is a late day two kind of guy you can get, that I think could come in and, you know, be an upgrade on a Derek Young that can contribute on special teams is Vinny Anthony Jr. out of Wisconsin. So those are just a few of the names that I've jotted down that I think are Seahawks and guys to kind of keep an eye on. But yeah, no, it's been a really good week. It'll be interesting to see the game tomorrow because they've added a few guys since yesterday's last practice, even that are going to come in and play. So it'll be interesting to see how it all looks tomorrow. So I might have a few more names to add to this ledger of draft possibilities.
Yeah, really sounds really interesting. So I'm definitely going to be locked into your draft coverage as well, like I always do. Like, speaking about the draft, like, when you talked about it, it didn't seem that bad. But looking at the current Seahawks roster now, would it be time, or would it be a good time for the Seahawks to trade, like, for a big star? I think you're you are still going for Max Crosby. You have been for a while. Is he still an option for the Seahawks? Because the one thing Mike McDonald really hasn't had in his defense in either in Baltimore or in Seattle is like really a closer. So would it be possible for the Seahawks to go for Crosby now with the draft capital they have? And would it even be more enticing for a Crosby to come to Seattle, like coming to a Super Bowl champion now?
I think it's harder to make that trade now than it was the trade deadline, because some of those assets and players are not going to be at your disposal. I think it's worth the conversation of, does Seattle try and go out and add somebody, which could be interesting. I don't know if you can. I think they could end up trading that first round pick, but maybe they're trading it for a guard. Maybe they're, you know, doing something like that instead of trading for an edge player. It's just, again, when I look at this class and I look at Seattle's needs, it lines up, but it also lines up to the point where you go to Seattle and you go, yeah, you don't have to press for anybody. You don't have to reach for somebody. Take best player available. Like, mm-hmm. And that's where I look at it and I go, okay, like if you do have that, you know, first round pick. Yeah, if you can make a deal where you're giving up this year's and next year's first round pick and a third round pick next year to go get Max Crosby, then yeah, okay, I'm on board for that. But I don't know if the Raiders, and again, new head coach Clint Kubiak being there, he may go potentially, if he is the head coach, I should say, if he goes there and goes, I don't want to get rid of Max. Like, I need Max on defense because we don't have a lot there. It makes it much more intriguing to see how Seattle decides to use their draft capital this year and what they decide to do.
So do the Seahawks have to give up more now if they want to like play like caliber of Crosby, considering the draft class is a bit weaker than previous, and the 2027 class, correct me if I'm not mistaken, will be much stronger. So would the Seahawks have to give up more now to get a big star than they probably have to do like in 2027?
I totally think they would have to, because you got to think that, you know, pick 31, pick 32 in a weak draft class really is a second round pick. It's not a first round pick. And so I think you may see it where if they are to give up anything, it would be more in the 2027 class, where maybe it's, hey, your first this year, plus your first next year, plus your second next year. Maybe that's what you have to get, which is a lot to give up for a player.
Yeah.
So, yes, because you don't have the player assets now afforded to you that you did, where whether it was a Mafe or Reek Wollin at the time, that's where it makes more interesting. That's why I think, you know, there's a higher chance of Seattle drafting an edge in this draft class with their first pick than there is of them, you know, trading away for somebody else, because it's just, it's a lot harder to do now.
Before we get out of here, like you said, you obviously took a lot of things when you went to the Senior Bowl. You've seen a lot of stuff. You've written a lot of stuff down. What have you coming up on the pod over the next couple of days until the Super Bowl?
So I'll actually be doing a show later today with Coach Derek from All 22 Films, breaking down kind of what the Patriots defense does, what their subs and base packages are, how Seattle can attack those things. So we'll be doing that later today. So that'll be coming out over the weekend here. I'll have a State of the Hawks next week, live show with Mookie Alexander, who'll be down at the Super Bowl. I'll also be potentially getting a beat reporter for the New England Patriots on the show to do a preview of that and get the New England side of things. We'll probably have another Seahawks syndicate next week once me, Brandon, and Dan all get situated back home. and we'll be doing, I'll have a live Seahawks aftermath the Monday following the Super Bowl. So there's a lot of content that's going to be coming out. And then I have a whole playlist now built into my YouTube channel there on Hawks Eye, which will have draft coverage stuff from Senior Bowl here. I'll be clips out once I get access to the portal of the practice film. And so if people are interested in players that were here, I can pull up practice reps, build, you know, different shows that'll come out based on position groups and needs for Seattle over the coming months here.
Awesome. Bryce. Thank you so much for coming on. Really, really looking forward to talking to you again, listening to your content. Have a great of rest of your day there. A great game tomorrow, and then obviously we're pulling for the Seahawks next week. So as usual, we are going to end with a Go Hawks.
Thanks for having me on, Jonas. Go Hawks.
Touchdown, Seahawks!
Weitere Infos zu den German Seahawkers gibt's natürlich auch auf unserer Website unter germanseahawkers.com.